Welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes we'll be featuring articles from the New York Times, from the Associated Press, from CNBC, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and unless otherwise noted, all articles are read as printed. Don't forget that podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article published in the New York Times on January 17th. This article is entitled, "The Hostages Escaped, But Synagogues Ask How Can They Be More Secure?" The subheadline, "The Hostages Whispered Instructions and Edged Closer to the Door, Part of Invaluable Training That Anxious Congregations Are Using." And this article is by Ruth Graham, J.C. Fortin, and Troy Clausen of the New York Times, Dateline Dallas. For 11 hours, the hostages talked to the ranting gunman, hoping that he would see them as human. They whispered about strategies, and they surreptitiously edged towards the nearest exit. But when the gunman ordered the men to kneel, they decided they had to take action. The rabbi grabbed a chair and heaved it at the gunman. The hostages ran for the door. The rabbi, Charlie Citron Walker, has been called heroic for his cool head and the decisive leadership that led to the dramatic escape of three hostages on Saturday from Congregation Beth Israel of Colleyville in suburban Fort Worth, Texas. But it was by his own account on Monday and that of another hostage, Jeffrey Cohen, it was years of security training prompted by threats to synagogues that allowed them to escape. In an interview, Rabbi Citron Walker said he had taken part in at least four separate trainings in recent years, from the Colleyville Police Department, the FBI, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Secure Community Network, a nonprofit group that provides security resources to Jewish institutions nationally. The sessions taught him that if you get in this situation, you have to do whatever you can, he said. It gave me the courage and the sensibility to act when we were able. Acts of sudden violence have become a grim part of American life. In cities and small towns, churches, schools, and concert venues have become the settings for terrifying scenes of mayhem. Synagogues have been even more acutely aware of threats since 2018, when an assailant armed with an AR-15-style assault rifle and multiple handguns entered the Tree of Life congregation in Pittsburgh on a Saturday morning. The man who was shouting anti-Semitic slurs killed 11 people. The Jewish community security world is looked at as pre-Tree of Life and post-Tree of Life, said Stuart Frisch, a national training and exercise advisor at the Secure Community Network. In August, Mr. Frisch provided an hours-long training session to Rabbi Citron Walker and several dozen congregants in the sanctuary at Congregation Beth Israel. Jonathan Greenblatt, who leads the Anti-Defamation League, said the Jewish congregants and synagogue leaders are more actively participating. "They've all done active shooter drills," he said. "They've all learned how to handle a hostage situation. They've all learned how to cope with terrorism." Rabbi Citron Walker compared the courses he took to CPR training, noting that it is rarely needed but crucial when the moment arises. "This kind of instruction is necessary for all of us as a society," he said. "Whether it's synagogues or grocery stores or mosques or shopping malls, it can happen." On Sunday, President Biden called the Colleyville attack an act of terror, and the FBI was investigating it as a terrorism-related matter. The suspect, Malik Faisal Akram, a 44-year-old British citizen, died, according to the police. Mitchell D. Silber, the executive director of the Community Security Initiative at the Jewish Community Relations Council of New York, said that there was a palpable fear that copycat attacks could occur in the coming weeks. "More and more, the Jewish community has accepted that, unfortunately, what it means to be a Jew in the United States in 2022 is that your institution needs to have guards, checkpoints, and security," Mr. Silber said. The training in Colleyville helped the hostages escape. Mr. Cohen, who is identified on the synagogue's website as its vice president, said in a Facebook post on Monday that the training from the Secure Community Network saved our lives. "I am not speaking in hyperbole here." He described a series of subtle strategies that set up the hostages with the opportunity to make an escape. When he was instructed to sit down, he chose a row with clear access to an exit. When he had an opportunity to rub a fellow hostage's shoulders, he whispered to him about the exit door. And when pizza was delivered, he suggested another hostage retrieve it from the door. Eventually, all the hostages were within 20 feet of the exit. At another point, Mr. Cohen used his feet to slowly move chairs in front of himself to potentially divert bullets or shrapnel. In the beginning, there were 4 hostages, Rabbi Citron Walker said, and they were able to build enough goodwill with the gunmen that one of them was released around 5 p.m. The other 3 remained as night fell, but conversations with law enforcement were not going well. There was a lot more yelling, a lot more threatening, Rabbi Citron Walker said. By around 9 p.m., the 3 men were near enough to an exit and were poised to run if the opportunity arose, he said. There was a real immediacy. Mr. Cohen wrote that he was prepared to wrap his prayer shawl around Mr. Akram's neck or shooting hand, but he did not get the chance. When Mr. Akram instructed the hostages to get on their knees, he wrote, I reared up in my chair, stared at him sternly. I think I slowly moved my head and mouthed, no. At that moment, Rabbi Citron Walker told the men to run, threw the chair and bolted for the exit, where a SWAT team ushered them to safety. Law enforcement then entered the building. We escaped, Mr. Cohen wrote in his account on Facebook. We weren't released or freed. Their escape, however, won't be the last word on how to handle security. The Colleyville attack is likely to force congregations to debate something central to a congregation's sense of self, just how wide to open their doors. Mr. Akram was let in as an act of kindness. Rabbi Citron Walker said that he had let the stranger in before Shabbat services that morning. It was an unusually cold day in North Texas, and the rabbi thought he was just coming in to get warm. He said that he made the man some hot tea. Stacy Silverman, until recently a member of Congregation Beth Israel, wondered why Mr. Akram would have been let inside on Saturday morning. After the deadly shootings at the Tree of Life Temple in Pittsburgh and Chabad Poway in Poway, California, Ms. Silverman said the congregation began locking the doors consistently. More American synagogues seem to be embracing security measures like the ones in Europe, said Mr. Greenblatt, who leads the Anti-Defamation League. In Europe, Jews have learned to live, from Istanbul to Madrid to London, Paris, Berlin, Brussels, Copenhagen, with very intense security precautions, he said. And what I would suggest to you is that a number of leaders in our community are concerned that that is now here. Over the weekend, the Jewish Federations of North America announced that it was speeding up the launch of a $54 million program to drastically expand its security initiatives. The Secure Community Network is part of that effort. Rabbi Jeffrey Myers, who survived the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, took classes on security and situational awareness through the Jewish Federation shortly before the shooting there. I'm alive today because I had that kind of training, he reflected on Monday. The sense of sanctuary that houses of worship in America used to be able to provide has disappeared. As it is, the anxieties spurred by the hostage-taking in Texas have reverberated across communities in the New York City region, which is home to more than 1 million Jews, the world's largest Jewish population outside of Israel. The New York Police Department temporarily sent extra patrols to several synagogues and key Jewish institutions around the city over the weekend, though they had not received any credible threats. At Park East Synagogue, a modern Orthodox congregation on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, Benny Rogosnitsky, a cantor, said that leaders are always on high alert. Still, after Saturday's hostage-taking spurred deeper anxieties among congregants, the synagogue plans to post additional security guards at entrances and closely monitor foot traffic. You think to yourself that if this goes to Texas, in a tiny community with so few people attending services, it really can happen anywhere, Cantor Rogosnitsky said, adding that finding a balance between safety and neighborliness has become a significant challenge. It's a very, very sensitive line that we have to walk, he said. You want the house of God to be a place that's open to people. If you walk past our building and to get into the synagogue and you see 2 or 3 armed security guards, that doesn't give you a feeling of closeness or intimacy with God. The next article this week on religion in the news comes from the Associated Press, dated January 16th. And this article is headlined, At Many Churches, Pandemic Hits Collection Plates and Budgets. This article is by Holly Meyer and Hallelujah Hadero of the AP. Biltmore United Methodist Church of Asheville, North Carolina is for sale. Already financially strapped because of shrinking membership in a struggling preschool, the congregation was dealt a crushing blow by the coronavirus. Attendance plummeted, with many staying home or switching to other churches that stayed open the whole time. Gone, too, is the revenue the church formerly got from renting its space for events and meetings. Our maintenance costs are just exorbitant, said the Reverend Lucy Robbins, senior pastor. And we just don't have the resources financially that we used to have to be able to do the kind of ministry work that we would like. Biltmore is just one of an untold number of congregations across the country that have struggled to stay afloat financially and minister to their flocks during the pandemic, though others have managed to weather the storm, often with help from the federal government's Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, and sustained levels of member donations. The coronavirus hit at a time when already fewer Americans were going to worship services, with at least half of the nearly 15,300 congregations surveyed in a 2020 report by Faith Communities Today reporting weekly attendance of 65 or less, and exacerbated the problems at smaller churches where increasingly lean budgets often hindered them from things like hiring full-time clergy. The pandemic didn't change these patterns, it only made them a little bit worse, said Scott Thuma, director of the Hartford Institute for Religion Research and co-chair of Faith Communities Today. Attendance has been a persistent challenge. As faith leaders move to return to in-person worship, first the highly transmissible Delta variant and now the even faster spreading Omicron have thrown a wrench into such efforts, with some churches going back online and others still open, reporting fewer souls in the pews. At Biltmore, for example, attendance at weekly services are down from around 70 pre-pandemic to just about 25 today, counting both in-person and online worship. After congregants voted last May to put the church property, a two-building campus perched on a verdant knoll just off I-40, on the market, church leaders are still figuring out what comes next, including where the congregation will call home. But they hope to use some of the proceeds from the property sale to support marginalized communities and causes like affordable housing. Unlike Biltmore, Franklin Community Church, about 20 miles outside of Nashville, Tennessee, doesn't have its own sanctuary, holding services instead at a public school. That turned out to be a blessing during the pandemic, with no need to worry about a mortgage, upkeep, insurance, or utilities. We wouldn't have survived if we'd had all that, said the Reverend Kevin Riggs, the church's pastor. Still, it has been a battle. During the 15 months that services at Franklin went online only, some members left for other congregations or got out of the habit of giving, according to Riggs. Weekly attendance is down from around 100 to less than 40, and the Omicron spike recently forced the church to go virtual again. The impact is felt in the collection plate. The money coming in now is just about a third of what it was before the pandemic, the pastor said. The church has cut spending where it could, turned to grants to try to make up the difference, and worked to raise more money from community members who don't attend but support the church's ministries, such as serving homeless people. We're surviving, but we have felt the hurt, Riggs said. Another struggling congregation, Friendship Baptist Church in Baltimore, is essentially living week to week. The predominantly black church received a PPP loan of more than $55,000, but that barely made a dent in expenses. The Reverend Alvin Gwynn Sr. has given up his pastor's salary and for now is living off Social Security checks and his other job in construction. Slumping attendance has hurt the bottom line there as elsewhere. Friendship Baptist counts around 900 active members, but only about 150 of them are showing up, making their donations especially crucial. The church is surviving because of the sacrificial giving of the 150, said Gwynn, who doesn't intend to start drawing a paycheck again until the church is stable. They give way, way more than a normal offering each Sunday individually. During the pandemic, experts said many congregations embraced online giving, which could boost congregation contributions by $300 per person annually, according to the Faith Communities Today report. More broadly, various other surveys and reports show a mixed picture on congregational giving nationwide. Gifts to religious organizations grew by 1% to just over $131 billion in 2020, a year when Americans also donated a record $471 billion overall to charity, according to an annual report by Giving USA. Separately, a September survey of 1,000 Protestant pastors by the evangelical firm Lifeway Research found about half of congregations received roughly what they budgeted for last year, with 27% getting less than anticipated and 22% getting more. Hope Presbyterian Church in Austin, Texas, a largely upper-middle-class congregation of about 400, is among those that have enjoyed relative stability despite the pandemic. The Reverend Josh Robinson had expected contributions to drop off when in-person services paused for more than a year, but they remained steady. So have member pledges for upcoming gifts in 2022. Some in the congregation even donated their government stimulus checks to the church, which used them to set up a fund to provide direct financial assistance to those who lost income during the pandemic. It all prompted the pastor to re-examine his own approach to the pandemic. I needed to step back and think, what did it mean for me as a spiritual leader to not have the same faith mindset since I was anticipating a downturn, Robinson said. Here were the members of the church stepping up. I had to lead into that, and rightfully I was able to do so with great joy. Even before, the church had embraced frugality in order to pay down its debt, which has fallen from $2 million in 2013 to less than $300,000 today. When services went virtual, savings on utilities and other costs helped keep the budget balanced. PPP loans of some $290,000 were also key to maintaining employees on the payroll and offsetting lost revenue from renting out space and other services. At West Harpeth Primitive Baptist Church, another church in Franklin, giving is down but only slightly. Hewitt Sawyers, the pastor, attributes that to the scant turnover among the more than 150-year-old historically black congregation's members, many of whom are committed to financially supporting the church and work in sectors that were less damaged by the pandemic than others. "We've just been wonderfully, wonderfully blessed," Sawyers said. Budget projections for this year are rosy enough that West Harpeth leaders are hopeful they can tackle a needed building renovation. "We are extremely optimistic about it," Sawyers said. "We're planning on trying to do that in 22, and we feel very, very, very comfortable about trying to get that done." We'll turn next to an article from a couple of weeks ago. This was published on December 29th on CNBC. And this article is titled, "Millennials Lead Shift Away from Organized Religion as Pandemic Tests America's Faith." And this article is by Seema Modi of CNBC. It's not uncommon for people to seek God during times of hardship. However, the opposite appears to have happened in the U.S. during the coronavirus pandemic. A Pew Research Center survey released earlier this month found 29% of U.S. adults said they had no religious affiliation, an increase of 6 percentage points from 2016, with millennials leading that shift. A growing number of Americans said they are also praying less often. About 32% of those polled by the Pew Research from May 29th to August 25th said they seldom or never pray. That's up from 18% of those polled by the group in 2007. The secularizing shifts evident in American society so far in the 21st century show no signs of slowing, said Gregory Smith, Associate Director of Research at Pew Research Center. That trend is pushing an increasing number of faith leaders to try to engage with millennials on their own turf. "I use Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, TikTok, stories, all sorts of things to go where people are, and that's where a lot of young people are," said the Reverend James Martin. Martin, 61, is a Jesuit Catholic priest in New York City and editor-at-large of America magazine. He's among the religious ministers who embraced social media at the height of the pandemic when places of worship were forced to shut their doors. "I started these Facebook Live programs at the beginning of the pandemic because I felt that people were really lacking a sense of community. Anything I can do to help people encounter God is important," Martin said. Still, as churches reopen across the U.S., attendance has been slow to pick up. The median in-person attendance has dropped by 12% over the past 18 months, according to a study published in November that was led by the Hartford Institute for Religion Research. While the trend is a cause for concern for houses of worship, it also serves as a wake-up call for religious leaders to refine the way they connect with their members, Martin said. "I think that it's taken a while, but most churches and religious organizations have realized this needs to be addressed," he said. At the East End Temple in New York City, Rabbi Joshua Stanton has given his sermons a jolt of energy in a bid to appeal to new congregants. "My sermons are getting shorter and shorter and more open, and what I try to encourage people to do is discuss them with me, argue about them, navigate with them, and come and study together so that we can all share an understanding," Stanton said. Stanton, 35, said he is also encouraging a safe haven in which members feel free to debate and argue with one another. New York-based designer Fletcher Eshbaugh, a recent Jewish convert, said debating is what he enjoys the most about East End Temple. The facets of the arguments and conflicts are super important, and I think that that's certainly a pillar of Judaism, that intellectual pursuit, said Eshbaugh. While many millennials are leaving organized religion, Eshbaugh embraced Judaism after being introduced to Jewish traditions through a couple of close friends many years ago. He did not grow up religious, but instantly felt a sense of belonging and fulfillment. I find a sense of spiritual and intellectual wholeness and an understanding of my place in the world through being Jewish. Continually asking questions and challenging ideas through Judaism fulfills me, he said. Elsewhere in New York City, younger Christian followers are flocking to Middle Collegiate Church on the Lower East Side, where the Reverend Jackie Lewis says no topic is off the table. She encourages her congregants, the majority of whom are millennials, to get involved and take a stand on political issues. We put social justice and democracy in the middle of faith in a way that really speaks to young folks, Lewis said. We've done an incredible amount of campaigning for the right to vote, the right to choose for women, immigrant rights, and racial justice. While Lewis said her teachings are inspired by the Bible, her approach is on the progressive political side, emphasizing spirituality and community over scripture. On its website, Middle Collegiate said its church is where therapy meets Broadway, where old-time religion gets a new twist. While some people may see this model as changing the traditional relationship Christians have with God, Lewis embraces it, saying, "That's exciting to me. I'm trying to get God out of the box." Middle Collegiate Church's congregation grew by 500 members during the pandemic, even though the 128-year-old church building itself was destroyed last year by a fire. It now has 1,900 members, Lewis said. Congregant Perrin Allen said he grew up in a conservative Christian household in Mississippi, but as a gay man, he struggled to feel accepted by his community. "I was a Baptist Christian, and so the way we saw things, and the way they communicated, you had to do things the way the Bible says literally. But I feel like the Bible and Jesus Christ believe in love no matter what, and I feel like I found that at middle. It's all about love, and love, period," Allen said. Disagreements on where church doctrine stands on specific issues remains a struggle for a number of younger Catholics. When it comes to the Catholic Church, there are some significant differences between church teaching and what young Catholics think, said Martin. "I think probably two of the biggest issues are women's ordination and the way that the church treats LGBTQ people. I think the difference is that maybe 25 years ago, people would have said, how can I stay Catholic and have difficulties with church teaching? Now I think young people just say I'm leaving," Martin said, "right? There's a lot less tolerance for what they see as behavior that is intolerant, according to them." Spiritual leader Deepak Chopra said, "Some of the things that we're told in traditional religion don't seem logical or rational, and more people are questioning these teachings." However, Chopra believes the interest in belonging to a community and finding a connection has never been stronger. "The pandemic showed us that people don't like isolation. In the absence of that human need for love, compassion, joy, sharing, attention, affection, appreciation, gratitude, people panicked," he said. Chopra, 75, is the author of 97 books with topics that range from Jesus and Buddha to the metaverse. He's amassed a following around the world and speaks at prominent events throughout the year. As the founder of the Chopra Foundation, he hosts global retreats where the spiritually minded come to heal, meditate, and connect. "The retreats are full," he said. "We just finished one in Mexico, another one in Los Angeles. People are flocking to these retreats." The events can cost thousands to attend. A week-long retreat planned for next month in Carefree, Arizona is priced from $6,000 to $8,000. Chopra said people skip church to attend these retreats and stressed that the drop in religious observance may be raising questions about how society is changing, but not about our spiritual nature. "The spiritual experience will never go away," he said. "The need to find meaning and purpose in our existence will never go away. The need to resolve what is inevitable suffering will never go away." As the pandemic rolls on, the younger generation's connection with spirituality is one way to engage with them, he said. Nonprofit leader Megha Desai, a Hindu, grew up in Boston but regularly spent time in India. She worshipped in beautiful temples in both countries. But Desai, who now lives in New York City, said the pandemic has changed her relationship with religion and prompted her to ask more questions. "These last 2 years have certainly tested my faith," Desai said. as it's hard to find sense in so many lives being taken from us. Desai still identifies as a Hindu, sharing that her relationship with God has evolved over time. I approach my connection to God from a more spiritual place than through the vehicle of religion. I think the Hindu rituals I do take part in are the festivals like Diwali, which connects me more to my culture than my faith, said Desai, who runs the Desai Foundation, a nonprofit organization that empowers women and girls through community programs to elevate health and livelihood in India. Indeed, that search to answer life's hardest questions will always be central to people, even if American young people continue to leave organized religion, said Chopra. Some of the things that we're told in traditional religion don't seem logical or rational, he said. So people are leaving, but humans still have the same questions. Is there meaning or purpose in our existence? Why do we suffer? We'll wrap up our time on religion in the news this week with a short story by Nicole Winfield of the AP. This is entitled, Bad Luck, Pope Acknowledges He Got Caught at Record Store. Won't have time to do this whole story, but it's worth your time. Dateline Rome. Pope Francis has long lamented that he can't walk around town unnoticed like he used to before becoming pope. But he seems to have nevertheless kept his sense of humor after he was caught on camera making an unannounced visit to a Rome record shop this week. Francis wrote a note to the Vatican reporter who happened to be in the right place at the right time Tuesday evening when the Pope slipped out of the Vatican to bless the newly renovated stereo sound shop near the Pantheon. Javier Martinez Brocal, director of the Rome Report's news agency, filmed Francis leaving the shop in footage that went viral and even got written up in the Vatican newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano. Martinez Brocal wrote the Pope a note afterward explaining that he wasn't a paparazzo and regretting Francis can't move around unnoticed anymore, but adding that the story provided a much-needed dose of good news for a world inundated with tragedy. I won't deny that it was bad luck that after taking all the precautions, there was a journalist waiting for someone on the taxi line, Francis replied. But he added, you can't lose your sense of humor. The shop owners later told the Associated Press that Francis had arrived unannounced at around 7 p.m. after he had told them during a previous encounter at the Vatican that he would come to visit. He walked in the shop and it was an amazing meeting, and as he promised, he blessed the shop, said shop owner Tiziana Esposito. Francis acknowledged that Martinez Brocal was only doing his job as a journalist when he recorded the event. Thank you for doing your vocation, even if it put the Pope in difficulty, he quipped. Co-owner Danilo Genio said Francis was a longtime customer who had popped in whenever he was in Rome for meetings at the Vatican when he was a priest, archbishop, and then cardinal in Buenos Aires. Francis, who grew up listening to opera on the radio and loves tango, Mozart, and Wagner, didn't buy anything this time around. But the shop owners gave him a CD of classical music. And that classical music playing us out means we've reached the end of our time this week on Religion in the News. We thank you so much for tuning in and hope you enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Don't forget that podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. Thanks again for tuning in today. We'll talk to you next time. I'm Brian LeBlanc, and this has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.